26. Gradually, we became accustomed to living without our legs. Needless to say, things did not go back to the way they had been before, not exactly. But our bodies acquired a new sense of balance, and a new kind of daily rhythm took hold. Eventually, we stopped noticing people who were unable to stand without holding on to something, or who were too tense to walk naturally, or who fell at random moments. We learned to control our bodies without too much inconvenience. Even Don began running around again at full speed. He would jump up on the roof of his house to bask in the sun, or leap at the branches of trees in the yard to bring the snow tumbling down. From time to time, he proved too successful at this game, and would come running to me for help after an enormous lump of snow had fallen on his head. But once I had wiped his face and rubbed his chin, he went right back to the tree, aiming this time for even heavier branches. No matter how much time went by, there was no sign that our left legs were going to rot and drop off. They remained firmly in place, fixed to our hips, but no one seemed to care. The number of people who were taken away by the memory police suddenly increased. Those who had used all sorts of tricks in the past to blend in could no longer fool the police after the disappearance of their left legs. It was surprising to see how many people had managed to hide in plain sight without being captured or resorting to safe houses. But now they found it impossible to imitate our new sense of balance. No matter how much they tried, something was slightly different about the distribution of the weight, or the alignment of the muscles, or the movement of the joints. And the memory police could spot it immediately. This crackdown, and the loss of the old man, meant that our communication with R's wife had now been suspended for some time. There was always the fear that the phones were tapped, and sending me for a face-to-face meeting seemed still riskier. Letters and packages from his wife were R's only ties to his former life, but receiving them was dangerous, and the best way to keep him safe was to keep him completely isolated. Still, at some point, we decided we could use the telephone to communicate if we managed to settle on a code. We decided that we would let the phone ring 3 times at a predetermined hour before hanging up, the signal that R was healthy and doing well. 3 rings from the other end meant the message had been received and understood. But in order to set up this system, I needed to go back to the elementary school for the first time in a long while. When I did, I discovered that the meteorological box was no longer mounted on its post. I found it in pieces on the ground, perhaps destroyed in the earthquake or crushed under the weight of the snow. I could see the thermometer, shattered and half covered by a pile of boards. I hesitated, wondering what to do, but in the end, I decided to push the letter in among the remains of the box. This tiny meteorological station had long ago been forgotten, and now that it was in ruins, it was even less likely to attract attention, making it all the more ideal for our purposes. My one concern was whether R's wife was still coming to look for letters here. Still, at the appointed hour, I dialed the number and let it ring 3 times before hanging up. Then I waited in front of the phone. After a moment, it began to ring. 3 rings that seemed to dissolve into the shadows and then silence. I had the feeling that the receiver had been trembling. I continued with the task of writing strings of words that made almost no sense. The feeling of purpose I'd had during my time as a novelist was gone. But compared to the emptiness I'd felt after the burning of the library, things were going more smoothly. At any rate, I'd gotten to the point where the shapes of certain words seemed to be returning. I could vaguely recall the fingers of the typist locked away in the clock tower, the pattern of the parquet floor, the mountain of typewriters, the sound of footsteps coming up the stairs. Still, it was extremely difficult to fill the boxes on the blank manuscript paper with characters, and the number of words I produced for an entire night's effort was painfully small. At times I grew so weary and frustrated that I wanted to throw the stack of paper out of the window. but then I would choose one of the objects I had borrowed from the hidden room, set it on my open palms, and breathe deeply to calm myself. Little by little, the boat slipped lower. When I took Dawn out for a walk, I stopped at the ruins of the library to sit and gaze out at the sea. It was lonely but peaceful there, with the sound of cars on the coastal road barely audible in the distance. The rumor had continued to spread that they were planning to build a headquarters for the memory police on the site, but the piles of burned bricks had not been removed, and there was no sign that construction would be starting anytime soon. "Do you remember how the old man looked sitting right here?" I asked Dawn. "I never imagined that would be the last time I'd see him." Dawn galloped about, clearly unconcerned with what I was telling him. "I should have noticed something was wrong that day, but he looked fine, his usual self. Though I suppose he did seem a bit sad, and he was never willing to ask for help. I wish I could put my arms around him and tell him there's nothing to fear, that everything will be all right, the way he always did for me. But he's gone, Dawn." I took a cracker from my pocket, broke it in pieces, and tossed them to Dawn. He jumped and twisted, deftly catching them in midair, and as I clapped my approval, he raised his nose and capered about, begging for more. "If I'd realized sooner what was happening, we might have saved him." I tried to put into words the regret that lingered in my head, though I knew that saying this aloud might only make things worse. Dawn noisily chewed his cracker. Now, when the waves were high, they hid the last bit of the boat still visible, and it seemed clear that it would soon vanish entirely beneath the surface. My heart ached when I thought about that day. Would I remember how we had eaten cake in the wheelhouse, or made our plans to build the hidden room, or stood on deck, leaning against the rail, watching the sunset? It was more than my empty heart could stand. By the time their right arms disappeared, people were less troubled than they had been with the disappearance of their left legs. They didn't linger in bed, wondering what had happened, or spend long hours trying to figure out how to get dressed, or worry about how to dispose of the disappeared item. To be honest, we had been certain something like this would happen sooner or later. The disappearances of body parts were, in fact, easier and more peaceful than earlier ones, as no one had to gather in the square to burn the objects or send them floating down the river. There was no uproar, no confusion. We merely went about our usual morning routines, accepting that a new cavity had opened in our lives. Of course, this disappearance brought subtle changes to my daily routine. I could no longer apply polish to my nails. I had to come up with a new way to type using only my left hand. It took inordinate amounts of time to peel vegetables. I had to move the rings I had worn on my right hand to my left. But none of this posed any real problem. I had only to surrender to each new disappearance to find myself carried along quite naturally to the place I needed to be. I was no longer able to carry a tray of food and climb down the ladder to the hidden room. I would hand the tray carefully down to R and then descend the rungs, one by one, leaning on him for support. Nor was climbing back up any easier, as I struggled with the ladder and the trapdoor before pulling myself through the narrow entrance. As I did, R would watch me from below with a worried look. "The time will come when I won't be able to get in and out of this room," I told him.
"Don't be silly. I'll just pick you up and carry you, like a princess," he said, holding out his arms toward me.
They still seemed surprisingly strong, though they'd had no more taxing exercise than organizing receipts, shelling peas, or polishing silver. They were supple and alive, unlike my right arm, which seemed to have hardened like plaster.
"That would be wonderful," I said.
But how can you hold something that has disappeared? His hands dropped to his knees, and he looked up at me and blinked as though he hadn't grasped the meaning of my question.
I can hold you. I can touch any part of you I want.
You can touch me. But what does it mean if I don't feel anything?
What do you mean?
Look, what about here?
And here?
As he spoke, he took hold of the limp rods that hung from my shoulder and hip. The hem of my skirt swayed. My hair fell across my face. Yes, I know you take good care of my body. And I know you can summon up memories of the music box and the ferry ticket, the harmonica, or the ramunet. But that doesn't mean the things themselves come back. It's no more than a momentary flash, like the tip of a sparkler when you light it in the dark. When the light's gone, it's instantly forgotten, and you can scarcely believe what you saw just a moment ago. They're all illusions. My leg and arm and all the rest of the things lined up on the shelves. I looked around at the objects in the room and then tucked my hair behind my ears. R let go of my arm and leg, and I scuffed my foot in and out of my slipper. The traces of his fingers on my ankle and calf vanished almost immediately as they reverted to their plaster state. My body will go on disappearing, bit by bit, I said, shifting my gaze from my toes to my knees, from my hips to my chest.
No, you mustn't say that.
It doesn't matter what I say. The disappearances will continue. There's no escape. I wonder what will be next. Ears, throat, eyebrows, my other arm or leg, or maybe my spine. And then what will be left? Or will nothing be left at all? I suppose that's it. Every last bit of me will disappear.
No, that's impossible. Aren't we here together, right now, in spite of everything?
He put his hand on my shoulder and drew me to him. But the arm and leg you see aren't really mine. No matter how much you care for them, they're just shells, empty skin. The real me is disappearing as we speak, slowly but surely being sucked into thin air.
But I won't let you go.
And I don't want to go. I want to stay with you, but that won't be possible. Your heart and mine are being pulled apart to such different, distant places. Yours is overflowing with warmth and life and sounds and smells, but mine is growing cold and hard at a terrifying pace. At some point it will break into 1,000 pieces, shards of ice that will dissolve.
But you don't have to go,
he said.
You just have to stay here. You'll be safe here, where all the lost memories are preserved, hidden along with the emerald and the perfume, the photographs and the calendars.
Me? Here?
Why not?
He said. Because it's impossible, I said, shaking my head in confusion at this unexpected idea. My arm slipped from the bed and struck his knee.
But it isn't. We're protected here. You, me, all the things that were hidden in the sculptures. Even the memory police haven't been able to find us.
But I know the end is coming. The disappearances used to happen suddenly, without warning. But I had premonitions before my leg and arm disappeared. I could feel my skin stiffening and growing numb. So I can tell something is going to disappear. It may be a few days from now or a few weeks, but it will come. And I'm frightened. Not because I'll disappear and cease to exist, but because I'll have to leave you. The thought terrifies me.
You mustn't be afraid,
he said, laying me down on the bed.
I'll keep you safe. Here, in my secret room.